This is The Political Scene, and I'm David Remnick.
If you came of age watching Spike Lee movies, as I did, or joints as he likes to call them, you quickly became familiar with his public persona. He was ambitious, uncompromising, and outspoken, and as far as his critics were concerned, maybe a little too outspoken. But Spike Lee was a groundbreaking voice, especially for black audiences. For some of us, we got to see the richness and complexity of our lives portrayed on screen for the very first time watching his films. His 40 years of filmmaking include classics like Malcolm X and Do the Right Thing, several documentaries including a couple about Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans, and recent favorites like Black Klansman and The Five Bloods. And he's still making movies destined to stir the pot. The subject of his latest project? Former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Classic Spike Lee.
Thank you, thank you. Can I say something first before we start? Is Brooklyn in the house? Oh, now we can start.
David Remnick sat down the other day with Spike Lee at the New Yorker Festival. They began talking about Spike's father, the bassist and composer Bill Lee, who died at age 94 this year.
In his time, your dad was the bass player that everybody wanted to play with. It's an amazing thing. Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, Aretha Franklin. He played on It's All Over Now, Baby Blue with one Bob Dylan, John Lee Hooker, everybody. He was also...
First album, Gordon Lightfoot. First album by Simon and Garfunkel. He's on Puff the Magic Dragon. He's on bass with Peter Paul Mary. So my father was the top folk bassist, but his thing was jazz. And when Bob Dylan went electric, everybody went electric. And people wanted to continue to work with my father, but he didn't want to play electric bass.
He wanted to continue playing upright.
Yeah, upright.
He was a traditionalist.
So my mother, who every weekend used to shop at Bloomingdale's on Saks Fifth Avenue, that had to stop. Because there was no money coming into the house because my father refused to play electric bass. My mother had to work. She started teaching at St. Anne's in Brooklyn Heights.
What was your relationship like with your father? It got complicated at times. Talk about that.
Growing up, in seeing the way my mother was working, coming home and cooking and cleaning for five crazy kids, and my father just be at this piano and just write music. But it wasn't until later that I saw that, this is his life. You know, he was not going to play music that he didn't want to play. It was great that we were able to work together. And that conviction he had, you know, I've taken a lot of that some things just can't compromise.
What was it like to work with him on films? He did the music for, I don't know, several.
He did all my student films, and She's to Have It, School Days, Do the Right Thing, and Mo Better Blues. What happened was is that my father did not believe in technology. So when you're doing a score, all right, this scene, Daddy, is 2 minutes long.
And only 2 minutes long, yeah.
And we go in the studio. It's like, what are you doing? So that's when I had to bring in Terrence Blanchard, the great composer. But Terrence Blanchard played with Branford Marsalis on School Days, on Do the Right Thing, and Mo Better Blues. When you see Denzel playing, that's Terrence playing. You see Wesley Snipes playing horn. That's Branford Marsalis.
Mm-hmm. Mo Better Blues.
Personal, man.
Well, tell me what it was like growing up in your house. Was the discussion of music and art at forefront?
Anybody has seen the film Crooklyn, that is autobiographical. So that was our house.
What? Turn the goddamn TV off.
I'm watching the Knicks.
I don't care what it is. No TV on a school night.
You can scream what you want. I'm watching this game.
Turn it off.
Mom, it's just a game.
Who is that?
That was Nate.
It wasn't me, Mommy.
The TV's not on.
On the campus,
we lived in a very artistic household. So thank God our parents were like, you don't have, they said, whatever you want to do, just be good at it. So there wasn't like steering us away from the arts. And I think a lot of times when it comes to the arts, parents kill their children's dreams because art, you know, we're not spending all this money so you could make pottery, you know, or a poet or something. You know, you'd be a lawyer, doctor, whatever you want. So it was just natural that we would be in art, but it wasn't drummed in our head. My mother was taking me to movies a little. My father hated Hollywood movies, so I was my mother's date.
What would she take you to see? What first excited you on the screen?
James Bond. My mother was a big Sean Connery fan. Loved James Bond.
Who are you?
My name is Pussy Galore.
I must be dreaming.
Was there, do you remember what movies started that were maybe a little on the higher on the food chain artistically than James Bond? Not that there's anything wrong with Goldfinger, but that you saw and you said, that's something I might want to do.
That didn't happen till college. I went to Mars College in Atlanta, Georgia. I had to choose a major. So I chose mass communications, was film, TV, print journalism, and radio.
That takes in a lot of area.
Mass communications. But film is what I feel film chose me, not the other way around.
But, you know, if you want to be a writer, forget the economics of it, you need a pencil. To be a film director, you need a whole bunch of other people. You need equipment. You need money. You need backing. And you need to be, to some degree, you need to be Napoleon. You've got to lead all these people. What in your personality drew you to being a film director as opposed to a novelist or a poet or a painter or whatever? Why did you express yourself through that?
Because film encompasses all those things you just nailed, that Neil, you just talked about. I was did my student films undergrad, and I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I knew that whole thing of driving out to L.A., flying to L.A. and working way up for the mailroom doesn't work for black people. So I'm going to be go to film school.
Yeah. And what at NYU Film School, who are you listening to? What are you watching that's starting to startle you and help you become you? What are you watching and listening to?
Everything. And I really thank NYU Graduate Film School for introducing me to world cinema, because a lot of the great filmmakers, you know, even though I've seen some samurai films, I didn't know Kurosawa made them. So it was an introduction to world cinema. I know what the Hollywood stuff is, but once I was introduced to different ways of thinking, different ways of making film, not just the Hollywood system.
I think A.O. Scott said that She's Gotta Have It and Jim Jarmusch's first movie really set off the independent film movement.
For me, Jim Jarmusch is my hero because I checked out equipment to him. And so, even though Scorsese went to NYU and Oliver Stone, they weren't there when we were there. Mm-hmm. So when someone you know, you check equipment to, makes it, then it's doable.
So tell me about breaking through. She's Gotta Have It was made for
$150,000? $175,000.
Where'd you get the money?
Well, I was doing crowdfunding before there was crowdfunding. I had a pen in hand, postcards, and a stamp. Remember postcards? When was the last time you licked a stamp? And I just postcards, everybody knew, to help me get money. But what we did was...
In other words, you're hitting up your parents' friends?
Anybody knew.
Take me through the stages of getting through from the imagination to into a movie theater, and all of a sudden I go to a theater and I see, wow, this is something absolutely new.
Well, it almost killed me, but I had great, great people around me who believed in this dream. One of my classmates, I went to John Dewey High School in Coney Island, and his mother just died, and in insurance he got $10,000. And he said, take it. I said, no guarantee, take it. And once the film became a hit, he bought a brownstone and four green. And is still collecting checks. And that film came out in 1986. So he got a brownstone, a very good price.
He certainly did. He certainly did. And where does this story come from? Had you been writing it?
She
have film it? Yeah, she's got
it. She's have it. It really, the concept really comes from Rashomon, the great film by the great Japanese director Akira Kurosawa, where a rape happens and you see all these different characters get their version of that incident. And this is want to flip it. So three men speak to the camera and get their version of who they think Nola Dawn is, who's having a sexual relationship, all these three men at the same time.
What about Nola Dawn? What do you want to know? I thought she was a freak. You know, freaky dicky. You ask why I continue to see her? I'm not crazy.
I think your career exploded even more with Do the Right Thing.
Okay. Mookie! So still
what?
How come you got no brothers up on the wall?
Man, ask Sal, right?
Hey, Sal, how come you got no brothers up on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Take it easy, man.
Huh? And you, hey.
Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some set.
By that time...
That was my third film.
Right, and 1989.
89.
And by that time, was it a hell of a lot easier to get financing, or were you finding Hollywood still a tough nut to break?
It was easier. But I still can't get everything I want to make now. So, I mean, unless you're Spielberg or Christopher Nolan, and they're not just to give you a blank check. But I'm not complaining. I'm in my fourth decade as a filmmaker, and I'm not slowing down, not stopping.
Have you, you've talked in the past about racism in Hollywood and other institutions. Has that changed at all in Hollywood? And if so, to what degree?
Well, there's many more people of color that are working in Hollywood today, in front of and behind the camera, but it's still not necessarily, you know, an even playing field. So the struggle continues.
Did you feel a special burden because of there were so few visible black directors in the 80s? Is there a special weight on your shoulder in terms of representation?
No,
in terms
it was
of,
a privilege because I was in a position to give people careers. I mean, a whole bunch of people came through 40 Acres in front of and behind the camera. And I remember we were getting ready to do Malcolm X, and the Teamsters at that point had no black Teamsters. So I had a meeting with the guy. I'm not going to say his name. I said, you got to get some black Teamsters. He says, well, we don't have any. Well, I said, you know what? Tomorrow the Food of Islam is going to be driving trucks. But they found some black Teamsters. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to mess with the fruit.
Do the Right Thing was not nominated for Best Picture Award. And in the
end... What? Danny got it for Best Supporting Actor.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Lost out to Denzel for Glory. And I got it for Screenplay. Dead Poets Society.
But it's not for Best Picture. And what
Who
won-
knows? Well, who's know what film won Best Picture that year?
I do. Driving Miss Daisy.
Driving Miss Motherfucking Daisy.
What did you feel at that very moment?
Well, let's move many years ahead. Black Klansman. What, we got nominated for Best Picture for that, but what film won that year?
Green Book.
What?
Green Book.
Yeah, I was like, damn, every time somebody's driving somebody, I lose.
When you see one of your films visually, they're incredibly distinctive. And
that's not just me. That's the great cinematographer I've had to work over the years, too.
So there's something called a double dolly shot.
Double dolly shot. I did not invent it.
Okay. So double dolly shot, for those of you who don't know, but if you saw it and I was smart enough to have a film of it, you'd know it right away. It's when the center figure is kind of still and the background is moving very quickly and it's very disorienting.
They're floating.
And what is it? Tell me about it technically, and what are you using it for? What is it meant to do emotionally to the viewer? And you see it in Malcolm X. It's in a lot of films. Blues.
Ernest Dickerson, my brother, fellow classmate, great cinematographer. We were young out of film school, and so we're just doing film school shit. And then showing off. And then Ernest and I said, you know what? We're out of film school. We're out of NYU. If we use this shot, it has to make sense. It has to be motivated. True story. So we're getting ready to do Malcolm X. And I became somewhat friends with the late, great Dr. Betty Shabazz, Malcolm's widow. And she told me that she felt that her husband, Malcolm, knew he was going to be assassinated when he went to Audubon Ball. He wanted to be a martyr. So when she told me that, I said, Ernest, man, we got to find a place. So then it hit me. We have a scene where Malcolm, played by the great Denzel Washington, D, he's going to Audubon Ballroom. I said, that's where we got to do it. And then I said, we got to use that Sam Cooke song, A Change Has Come. And so that song, coupled with the circumstances and the double A shot, is the best use of it so far that we've done. But when we do it now, it has to be motivated.
Sparingly.
Yes.
Sparingly. Are there any other signature moves that you've either used or abandoned or you think of as part of your film vocabulary?
We have a lot of time with people speaking to the camera. Double cuts where we repeat, like we might have somebody, people hugging, might see them hug twice.
Mm-hmm.
Just try to be innovative with the camera and keep the camera moving and not just stand there.
Mm-hmm. Do you find it harder as you get older to come up with new stories, new material, or does life keep coming at you hard enough so that well is full?
No, I have a plethora of ideas. It's the money. You know, you gotta finance that stuff. So
that's the big burden.
Yes, and my dream project is a film called Save Us, Joe Louis, which I co-wrote with the great Bud Schulberg. Bud Schulberg won an Oscar for On the Waterfront. Bud Schulberg is inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame as a writer. And I got to know Bud. He introduced me to Kazan. And Bud was at the two Joe Louis Schmeling fights in Yankee Stadium. So this screenplay is about the relationship between Joe Louis and Max Schmeling, who was not a Nazi, but he was on the tyranny of Hitler.
In your vision of it, who would play those two actors, those two roles, Schmeling and Louis?
I don't want to jinx it, but I co-wrote it with Bud, and for 2 years, Bud would call me every day. I mean, he was on his deathbed. He would call me, and what kept him alive was the idea that we're going to make this film together. And he was a Spike. Yeah, that, you know, you read Bud?
I knew him.
So, yeah. Spike, did you get the money yet? I'm working on it. So I made a promise to Bud on his deathbed, we're going to get this film made one day.
Now, you've been doing a lot of documentaries. I was honored to have the privilege for it to briefly be in a couple of them, one about New York City and one that's forthcoming about Colin Kaepernick. And you do this thing. It's really not disconcerting, but nerve-wracking. You put somebody in a chair, and the camera is about 2.5 feet from your face.
You were great.
And you're, yeah, we'll see. Right now you're doing Colin Kaepernick. How many hours of footage do you have?
Just
interviews?
Just over it, yeah.
Hundreds of hours.
And it's going to break down to what?
Five parts.
Of each an hour and a half, an hour and change. So who sits there and goes through over and over? That's all you? How collaborative
is that? No, what I do is that I look at the dailies with the editors, and then they go off and do what they got to do, and they show it to me. But it's, you got to put the work in. You can't fake the funk. And this documentary is taking a long time.
Why is that?
Story keeps going.
He's not coming to the Jets, I hate to tell you.
He might not ever play again.
This is the most important question I can possibly ask you. Why don't you organize a team to buy the Knicks?
They're not for sale.
Yeah, you could do it and make them better, because I got to tell you, I can't take it anymore. I don't know how you do this.
We haven't won in 50 years. The last year was the 72-73
season.
But we're going to be good this year.
Why are we going to be good this year again?
What did the Brooklyn faithful always do? What did the Flappers faithful always say?
Wait
till next year. Well, this is the year.
This is it.
This is the year.
From your lips to God's ears, I want to ask you some collaboration questions. Denzel Washington, what is the quality that you find in him that, and you bring it out in so many different films? Why is he as great with you? Not that he wasn't great in Equalizer 3, which I loved.
Yeah, I got nothing to do with that. Denzel, in my opinion, is the greatest living actor today. You could feel his power, his sensitivity, his humanity. And he just, the way he carries himself, like, he's not fucking around. And if you're on a set, whether you're a boom, whatever, I think you're not doing your job, he's going to let you know.
He lets you know?
Yeah.
How?
Spike.
That's good. That was good.
But you know how I direct Denzel? All right, Denzel, what do you want to do next? All right. Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, we'll do it. But he's the GOAT.
You're going to do another one with him?
I would love to.
You got anything in mind?
Not yet, but we're
too
talking.
Old to be Joe Louis? Okay.
Yeah. Played Hurricane Carter.
That's right. How long can you do this? You look at Scorsese's...
Kurosawa's 86.
Yeah.
I'm 66.
Is that the idea?
I got at least 20. I got to get the Kurosawa.
Gotcha. All right.
Got to.
Spike Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. David Remnick, give it up for David.
Filmmaker Spike Lee talking with David Remnick at the New Yorker Festival. And if you've been an admirer of Spike Lee's movies over the years, you're definitely going to want to check out what he considers the list of essential films. There are 95 movies on this list, and some of them are movies you would totally expect to see, like The Godfather and Raging Bull. And of course, there's a few Kurosawas on there as well. But there's some surprises too, movies like Mad Max and Kung Fu Hustle, if you can believe it. You can find a link to Spike's list on our website, newyorkerradio.org.